Welcome to How to Best Prepare Our Kids for Life Post-Secondary School. My name is Sarah Dimmerman, also known as Help Me Sarah, and today I'm in conversation with Domenico Capolongo, or Mr. C, as he is affectionately referred to by the high school kids he has been teaching English to in a high school in York Region, Ontario, for the past 17 years. In his downtime, Dom is also an assistant karate instructor to kids and adults, and also finds time to write, as he has authored 4 books, 3 poetry collections, and 1 short fiction collection. Dom is married and dad to 2 sons, age 14 and almost 11. Welcome, Dom.
Thanks, Sarah. Really happy to be here and talk about all this stuff, and hopefully some of the listeners can get some insight on how to help kids prepare for the next stage.
Absolutely. So let's just jump right into some questions here. So as I mentioned, you've been a high school teacher for 17 years. So what have you seen and heard that has best prepared you to comment on how we can best prepare our kids for life post-secondary school?
So much. When I started teaching, I got to a great opportunity to work with at-risk kids. I mean, I don't even like that model, at-risk. I think we're all at risk. But working with kids that were struggling, so I did that, and also working with really high-level academic kids trying to succeed in high-pressure fields and professions. So I think I've seen a lot of kids grow from 14 years old to their early 20s and keeping in contact with them, and now a lot of them are in their early 30s. So I think I've been able to see development of young people from 14 years old to early 30s. So I think it's a good opportunity to talk about.
So it sounds like you've actually followed up with kids even when they've finished high school.
Yeah, and now in their early 30s, contacting them.
So like a longitudinal study,
yeah.
An informal longitudinal study.
All anecdotal, and I haven't done any, you know, psychological research, but I think it's important to think about.
Right. Yeah. So you've probably made some, you've probably created some hypotheses in your own mind in terms of what's worked and what hasn't, and also probably seen different things that have happened over the years. I'm not sure if you've seen a change even in the school system in regards to, you know, when you first started out, were we helping kids differently to how we're helping them now? What is the role that teachers have played before? What are they playing now? And what do you believe the role is of a teacher in preparing our kids for life after post-secondary?
Yeah, I think I've seen a lot of changes. And also, it's a pet project for me to interview people and say, well, how are you doing now? And how can we prepare the next generation? So, I think the role, I think we still have a profound impact on young people growing up.
Teachers do.
Yeah, really, we can make a real profound impact, but it's just another piece in the puzzle. We have society, we have big, not big business, but, you know, I think in the last 20 years, for the first time ever, they decided to market to preteens and teens. They broke, the marketing
you mean
has
advertisers?
Broken. Yeah, advertisers have broken up the teen market about maybe 10, 12 years ago into preteen, middle teen, and older teen and marketed directly to them.
Yeah.
So
you're competing with that in some way, do you think, as a teacher?
Yeah, you're competing with that. I'm seeing an effect that way. Society, parenting, shifts in parenting.
So just to go back to the teacher's role, so, you know, obviously you take your work very seriously, and you're also able to apply some of your strategies at home, I would imagine, because your kids are getting to that point too. But, you know, do you think we actually give teachers enough credit for the work that they do? I mean, do you think high school teachers tend to just teach this subject, or do you think that I've noticed, like even in my own practice, that kids are coming in with different kinds of issues, and I hear from teachers who are clients that they're now dealing with a lot of social work type issues.
Yeah,
you know,
teaching. Yeah, whenever you get a shift in a system or a focus on need, it creates impact. So if, for example, we've decided as a society that mental health issues for our young people are so important, we turn up the amplifier in that, and it has a repercussion. The repercussion is on the teacher, on the parents. Now we're very sensitive to stress management and anxiety. So now, yes, you become kind of a social worker.
So are you allowed to, or are you able to integrate any of that kind of stuff into your work as an English teacher?
Yeah, English is so great to teach because it's basically psychoanalytical, because you use the characters and the characters' issues,
right,
to have kids analyze it on a literary level, but then you always slide in their personal life.
Well, they're projecting some of themselves into the characters, maybe.
Yeah, and an interesting thing that happened actually just a couple weeks ago is, the popular series 13 Reasons Why,
right,
the book and the TV show. So you want to encourage kids who are suddenly thinking about this stuff to know the network of care that we have.
So I know, just for people who haven't seen it, mm-hmm, the theme is suicide, right?
Yeah, it's about a young girl who commits suicide and leaves cassette tapes to the 13 people who
have
impacted
contributed.
Or contributed. So, you know, that's on the kids' minds, but we're studying Hamlet last week and we get to the to be or not to be speech.
Right.
And he's contemplating suicide.
Right.
So you could be the kind of teacher that goes, okay, here are the three questions, do them and we're done. But you know you're in a room with young people that are learning about themselves. They're grappling with issues of just growing up. All of us have had to do it, sexuality, psychological stuff. So you have to, I think it's important to us. The role of teachers is extremely important, and not to be
undervalued.
And I don't need an award, but I think we need to realize that in a room of 30 kids that are 16, they're going through so much, and we can do so much for them.
So, I mean, and like, I guess, as you said, being an English teacher has its benefits, mm-hmm, if you're that way inclined, whereas like math, they may not be able to integrate some of those mental health issues, whereas, as you said, you can really draw from a lot of what you're doing.
Yeah.
So you have to be almost better prepared, yes, as a teacher too, right?
Well, it's, you know, in the other classes, it's a little more silent. You have to look for different cues.
Right.
The young man that comes in always with a hoodie or very sullen when you're trying to teach times tables, you have to be aware. But that sullen child, if I'm doing Shakespeare, all of a sudden gets triggered or reacted to something.
Right.
And you can draw him out and help him.
So just going back to the original topic in, mm-hmm, terms of how can we prepare kids for life after post-secondary, do you, when kids come into you, especially into your grade 11 or 12, mm-hmm, class, what grades are you teaching?
Is this year, grade 12 mostly.
Okay. So especially in grade 12, is there, like, what do you see? Do you see that kids are so-called prepared for life post-secondary?
I think yes. In general, I would say yes, academically, but I think all the soft skills around being prepared for the tougher things.
Like what?
Like, I think, okay, I actually brought it down to about four things. If I could put my teacher hat on and my writer hat on, I think reading and writing, but mostly writing, we're noticing when I talk to the kids in their 20s, they're struggling with being able to write better. So they can do it, but I've noticed in the last little while, it's more of a challenge.
When you say writing, do you mean actually like putting an essay together, or do you mean expressing their feelings in writing?
No, they're used to, I think it's the actual craft of the essay and the editing and the high level writing that is in demand in the workforce.
Why do you think they're not better prepared for that?
I think they're prepared in terms of, you know, if I take all my grade 12s, do you know what an essay is? Do you know what a paragraph is? They're all prepared, but now it's to raise their game.
But I'm also thinking about their lives outside of school. Mm. And kids are so used to writing in very small snippets, like in text, right?
Yes.
So whereas when you and I were growing up, we were writing letters.
Yeah.
you know, and so we didn't think in snippets.
Yes.
And I wonder if that's made things harder for them too, because they're so used to that, and, you know, YOU becomes you, and even, I've noticed even in professional emails, sometimes I'll even get, you know, a you for a YOU.
My advice is for parents and teachers listening, is for the writing is reading. So if we actually stop a kid, a child, a young person, and say, and if you can imagine, it's a generational thing. So if you can imagine, they have read billions and billions of fragmented sentences.
Right, right.
And I, for example, growing up, have read millions of actually well-formed sentences so that when I edit my work, intuitively I can tell what
you
a sentence is.
Tell the difference.
Their intuitive, you know, idea of what a sentence is and how to edit something, because they don't edit. So I still edit emails. It's just a force of habit.
Yes,
before I hit send,
too.
I read it over.
I do too.
But they don't do that in a text or a Snapchat. And I don't blame them. I had a student actually go put up their hand when I was trying to teach this. And they said, so what do you expect us to do? Edit our text messages? And I said, no.
I would say yes.
You know, I mean, I'm not expecting them to change their habits. When you try and get people to self-actualize and think about themselves, you don't want them to necessarily feel negative. You want them to go, oh, I'm aware of my weakness. My weakness in writing is that I need to proofread more.
Mm-hmm.
So are they better? Are they prepared for school? Yes, but society has given them a big weakness, which is the social media piece. Like, it's the first time I've ever seen a lack of periods. It's starting, and then I researched a bit. It's not deep research, but no one puts... It's rude for young people to put a period at the end of a text message.
It's supposed to... It's like
ending the conversation.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
I do it because intuitively, it's a sentence.
Right.
So if I text you and go, Sarah, I'm going to be 5 minutes late, I put period and send the text.
Right, but for them, it's like...
It's rude.
So in some way, I'm thinking, you know, the topic is... Are we preparing them for life post-secondary school? And had we been having this podcast 20 years ago, we might not have been. But in some way, if this is the way that everybody communicates, does it matter?
Yes, and
I'll
tell you why.
As the older generation dies out.
No, but I'll tell you why. Because people listening right now who are working in business and who are working in any kind of field, hiring them. Yeah, and hiring them.
Maybe that generation still exists currently.
But they know that it matters. The power, I believe, you know, as a writer and as an English teacher, the power of well-crafted language.
The power of the period.
Yeah, the power of the period. But the power of well-crafted language will take, you want to prepare your child and
have them
be successful. Just have them read and read and read and read.
And that's a tough thing to get them to do, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that's part of your job, is turning them on to stuff that they will enjoy reading, as opposed to feeling that it's an obligation to read.
Yeah.
But just step aside from the academics for a bit, because I want to also focus on those other skills.
Yeah.
Like, you said you've met with students probably informally, and maybe I remember you saying something about inviting some kids to your classroom.
Yeah, so one of the most exciting things I did is, because now I'm getting middle-aged, so the distance between me and the real world, I mean, I think teachers have to realize we're in this microcosm of a building, and our concept of what the real world is...
Mm-hmm.
People listening will go, oh yeah, I've got a teacher living next door. They're out of touch with reality. So as a teacher, you must always try and say, what is the real world that I'm actually preparing these people for? So what I did was I invited graduates of the high school who are in the middle of their first year to return on their reading
week. First year university or college, yeah.
And to speak to the
grade
present
12.
Class.
That's
and so
great
I
idea.
Moderated and passed the microphone. And for me, it was amazing.
What did you hear?
And for people listening, it's important to know if your child's about to head into university and you're worried, they're worried about friends, they're worried about all this stuff. Okay, so this is what they said, basically, is that the university that we went to 20, 30 years ago is exactly the same, in that the quality of work and the expectation of the work is the same. the expectation of handing things in on time and having high quality research work is the same.
Laying things out in the proper format.
All that stuff has remained, so I was very happy
to
know that. But the most exciting thing for, and the best change I would say in university, is that there's so much help at in college and university, and I'm going to even guess in the big business workforce to get help. So a lot of the students were saying there's so many centers on
campus. Yeah.
But not just for academics, for the mental health. And I was so excited because the kids were saying, you know, I finally discovered the blah, blah, blah center at my university, and I have a life coach.
Right.
I have, a therapist. I mean, it's very fascinating.
Yeah. But so it's interesting because, again, going back to the original topic, how do we help to prepare kids? Mm-hmm. You know, you and I had a discussion once about how sometimes we don't want to use the word enable, but we don't allow kids to sometimes go through the school of hard knocks. I'm not saying that I agree with you that these resources are amazing to have in place. Mm-hmm. But in some way, you know, are we also saying to our kids, you need all these services in place in order to function? Not to say that I take them away, but we had talked once about, you know, the idea of if a student comes into a classroom and doesn't know how to use, like, his graphomotor skills are weak and he doesn't know how to use a pen to write, we give them a computer right away,
right?
And then we don't often give them maybe the occupational therapy that they require in order to become better writers with their hands. So
just to give a little bit of a history of the education system in the last 20 years, I think we're in a huge pendulum swing. So at the beginning, I think, you know, historically, if you weren't doing well at school at 16, you could drop out and go get a job.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think what we discovered as a society was, is that really what we should be doing? Shouldn't we be helping young people to succeed and to get through high school and to get their high school diploma? And then some government shifts happen and said, okay, no, kids must remain in school to 18, and our vision and focus for education is to make them as successful as possible and do whatever we can to get them to graduate. Where we're slightly possibly losing the focus is we need to get them ready for the real world. And not real world in a cold, dark way, but in a real world way. So to deal with loss, to mm-hmm. deal with struggle, to deal with harsh realities. So how do we do that? I think we need to accept as parents and as teachers one idea, which is our job as parents is to create autonomous individuals that are positive members of society. So in order to do that, we need to allow our kids to struggle. And we need our kids, we need to be okay with our kids being angry at us.
Mm-hmm.
And that's so hard for parents.
How does the anger at us fit in with the struggle? Is there a...
Well, if you know what you're doing is right, you know that it's okay for your child to be upset about it,
mm-hmm.
because through this struggle, they will learn that, you know what, they're right. I need this.
They'll know that you as a parent put them on the right track, you mean?
Right, yeah. And you're doing it out of love and out of care and out of your job. Your
right.
job is to, you know what, we need to do this. Don't pick that scab.
Right. Right.
Leave the Band-Aid on.
Right.
All the things we do.
So I'm thinking, for example, my daughter was away at a leadership conference and was very afraid to go. And I said to her, you know, go, because I think you'll do really well. But you need to know that if you're really having a bad time, we will always come and pick you up.
Right.
And then I said to her, however, I won't run to pick you up.
Mm-hmm.
I'll need to know, and I'll probably encourage you to continue and try to stay a little longer. So is that the kind of thing that you're talking about?
Mm-hmm.
So that if your child calls you from university and says, you know, I'm really struggling. Now, I mean, there are situations that I'm aware of where kids have gone to university is very, they've always been anxious kids, and then right. they go away to university and they just can't manage. And then sometimes that's the exception. But for the average kid who is going to be, you know, anxious going, it's important that a parent, you know, accept that and acknowledge that that's normal.
Right.
And get and not cocoon his or her child and say, okay, don't go then. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
Yeah, you know, unconditional love. You know, your daughter knows my mom is there for me. So she might be struggling at this leadership conference, but she knows that you're there.
I'm in the wings.
But that also you believe in her struggle. So if she right. were to call you and say, I need to verbalize my struggle.
Right.
Not please. And then you don't go, well, I'm driving there right away. It sounds like you had a bad day.
Right.
When she's not even asking for that.
That's right. Yeah.
I mean, another interesting shift we're having in society is that, you know, about 10, 12 years ago, they coined the term helicopter parents.
Right.
The parent that brings the little child to the playground and when they're going up the slide has to hold them.
Right.
Well, those children are 20 now.
Right.
So what have we done to them? I want to share.
So I just want to be yeah. careful that the people aren't listening. You know, sometimes it is important to stand behind your kid when they're climbing the jungle gym.
Oh, 100%.
So I guess evaluating their age and everything like yeah, that and their ability.
Yeah, don't allow your kid to, you know, play with blades, live blades,
right.
or to fall when they're on the monkey bars, I guess.
Right.
And that's not a good definition of helicopter parents. And I agree. I don't actually like the term. I think what I'm saying is that it's okay for our kids to struggle and lose, but it's not okay to abandon them and
right.
to make them feel
unsafe.
Unsafe or unloved.
Well, a colleague of mine wrote a book called The Gift of Failure, mm-hmm. which is all about that. You know, I think there's another one called The Blessing of the Skin Knee,
mm-hmm.
you know, which is all those books, and I'm sure there's others, talk about, you know, letting your child fall and graze his knee and knowing, you know, as a metaphor for learning how to. And it's amazing because sometimes we think that we're doing our kids a favor by picking them up too quick, you know, very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, sometimes we're not. I remember when I was growing up, if I were to spill something, how badly I would feel when my mother came to clean it up for me.
Mm-hmm.
I felt that I couldn't.
Right.
Right. So we think that we're helping our child by cleaning up their spill, but in fact we need to allow them to feel that they can clean up their own spills.
Yeah, and when we get to the real world, there's something that stayed with me for a while. About three years ago, they interviewed the president of Workopolis,
okay.
which is a website on how to get jobs.
Yeah, yeah.
So he had this advice. And it's very profound for parents and for teachers. He said, parents listening right now, please stop doing the following things. You are not helping your children prepare. Number one, let your children get a job. And I've been telling this for students for a long time.
Yeah.
I think we're under the impression that volunteering at hospitals and going on courses and doing things looks better on a young person's resume than dishwashing. But what's happening in the workforce now, people that I know that are hiring 20-somethings, they're hiring people that have come out of university that could be on dean's lists, could have won tons of awards in their private life, and are doing amazing things, but have never held a job. And we know that holding a crappy job teaches many things. One,
oh, yeah.
resilience, dealing with terrible
employers,
retail jobs, but we've taken that away from kids because
we think that we don't want them to work too hard.
We don't want them to struggle. I struggled as a kid, so
right.
I don't want my son to be yelled at by that terrible boss. Instead,
right.
I want you to volunteer at the cancer ward. Wonderful thing to
do. Or if the boss does yell, I'm going to go and speak to that boss.
Right. So the other thing the Workopolis guy said, this is mind-blowing, but many people can relate to it. Stop going to interviews with your 20-something kids.
Mm-hmm.
So you are so interested and so worried, they actually show up at the interview and want to come into the interview.
Really?
So that's mind-boggling,
yeah.
I think. But not the intuition, don't get me wrong. As a parent, you want to help
yeah.
your child.
Yeah,
that's
the intentions
not wrong.
Are good, yeah.
But to realize what help is.
Right.
The other thing you said is, please stop putting yourself down on your child's resume as a reference.
Really? That happens?
That happens because You want I'm the best advocate for my child.
But would anybody call a parent as a reference?
Maybe it's a different last name, so he said stop doing that. The next thing he said, which I found mind-boggling too, stop calling the employer after they've not chosen your child to ask the employer
why. How could you not have chosen my child?
Right. All the intuition again is right. I spoke to a few professors. Because now we're sending our children to university at 17. They're not 18.
Right.
So they're struggling first-year university, which has happened since the beginning of time. But parents are calling professors about marks.
That's where the helicopter parenting term came in, I think.
Yeah, and you know...
It was originally coined because of that kind of thing.
And now they've made a new term. Last year at a conference, a professor, I think it's a Black Hawk parent. Because Black Hawk is a type of helicopter that's an attack helicopter. Helicopter parents just hover over the kids.
Yeah.
That's the old term. The new term now is the helicopter's not just hovering, it's advocating and attacking.
Right. So as parents ourselves, we both know, as you said, with best of intentions, right?
Right.
We think we're helping our kids, but what you're saying is sometimes we're doing them a disservice, both in terms of helping them avoid struggles and conflict and all that kind of stuff. But we're also maybe doing a disservice to them if we're giving them a bad name because we're too interfering. And one of the things I often advocate, even for parents of kids in high school, is make sure that you and your child have a plan together.
That's great.
So that if you are having a problem with something that's going on at school, collaborate with your child in terms of how you're going to work on it. Because if you're the one always calling the teacher or the principal and your child doesn't even know about it, he or she could be very embarrassed.
Yeah.
And you're not giving them the tools then in terms of helping them prepare for the real world.
I think it's great. Excellent advice. And I think if your child's about to go to grade 9, when you look in the mirror, define your job as coach.
Right.
So your child comes home and says, the math teacher gave us a test, or I feel like no one's listening to me, or I'm very anxious, I have this presentation.
Right.
Tell them, well, what are you going to do about it? Sounds like you have a problem.
Right.
I'm here to support you. What do you think you can do?
Right.
But our knee-jerk reaction is, I'm going to call that principal. I'm going to get that math teacher on the line.
Right.
My child's amazing.
Right.
But the coaching, you know, changing your hat to a coach.
Oh, that's okay.
Because and start to see your child as an adult, which is so impossible. My mom doesn't see me as an adult. She tells it's going to rain tomorrow. Thanks, Mom. And that's loving, right? But,
And the red flag, I think, is when you say to your child things like, you know, what do you want to do? What do you think is a good idea?
And
he
pause.
Or she says, but the red flag is when he or she says, I don't know, I want you to tell me. You know
right.
better than me. And then you know that your child, I always say, you know, don't teach your child what to think, teach them how to think.
Right.
You know, and how to think is, as you said, engaging them and asking them questions. What do you think is a good plan? Why don't you try it out? If it doesn't work, you can try something different. But as you said, the coach idea or kind of guiding from the prompting from the wings is a good idea.
And holding your tongue and having, you know, it's hard as I'm a parent. So when I hear stories, I want to verbalize with my partner in front of my child about how crazy I think that is.
Right.
But if I do that, I've just taught my child
to undermine
the authority. Now, we don't want people to be blindly following
compliant,
authority.
Right.
But at the same time, we don't want them to go, oh, yeah, well, my dad thinks that this is crazy.
Because then that could transfer to when he or she goes into the real world.
Right.
And starts, you know, not knowing how to deal with issues with a boss, for example. So it's, you know, working with a teacher, at least... You know, there's not as much at risk.
And, you know, you almost want to make it part of the school system that you have to get a job at No Frills for 3 months.
Yeah.
Because those skills, paper route, No Frills, washing dishes, these are jobs we need.
Well, even I know my daughter has had a job for the last year or so and is working a lot with people.
Mm-hmm.
So it's also the customer service and working with different kinds of people.
And personalities and
how to deal with different personalities and mm-hmm. being able to... And the other benefit of working when you're still at home is that you can come home and talk to a parent about it and get the guidance.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you've never worked
right.
and then you move out, you have no one maybe to kind of run that by.
And from that coach thing, hey, Mom, I came back from work. and this strange person was yelling at me, this is how I dealt with it. Now, from a parenting standpoint, you want to go, is my kid going to be okay?
Yeah.
Talk to me about how you dealt with that difficult situation. Oh, yeah, what a relief to
really
go
well.
And say, mm-hmm. she or he did it on their own, got
right.
through that difficult situation,
right.
and she's going to be okay next year trying to do her laundry at university.
Well, those are some of the other skills, right? I mean, we've talked a lot about very important skills like handling conflict and conflict mm-hmm. resolution and peers and group work and all that kind of stuff and loss you mentioned. But then there are all those other skills, as you said, like, oh, I guess school can't really prepare kids for doing things like laundry and, you know.
Yeah, but, you know, the critical thinking piece
yeah.
happens, and we need to remember that we need to give people the time to solve problems. And the thing is, I can tell the students that have been never had to think, or they've not never had to think, but when they reach an obstacle, the way they ask for assistance,
right.
they haven't thought about it first, tried to solve it, and then focus their question.
So they might just automatically, when they get to an obstacle, just come and get help right away as opposed
right.
to looking inside for ideas.
So like I remember an example from years ago, I came to a student and said, this is a simple, tiny little example. I said, oh, the author you've chosen for your assignment was just interviewed yesterday in the Globe and Mail.
Yeah.
And without missing a beat, he said, where do I get the Globe and Mail? Not a strange question
yeah,
to
yeah.
have in your mind.
Yes.
But when you have it in your mind, then you try and answer it.
Right.
And then you maybe can get to the next level.
Right.
But as parents, do we give our children enough time? You know, we're very educated parents, and I
right.
don't just mean school educated. And we spend a lot of time with our children. We want to solve the, you know, we bring them to the library, we choose the books for them.
Right.
Do we let them wander through the library and find a book for themselves?
Right.
You know, that kind of stuff.
One of the best things that I think that I'm really happy that both my daughters have learned is I really encourage them to manage. You know, there's so many things every day that you deal with in terms of like a hydro bill or your mm-hmm. bell bill or your statement comes in and it's got the wrong amount. And, you know, I would say that in a week there's at least two people that mm-hmm. I'm contacting to try to resolve issues with.
Mm-hmm.
And from a pretty young age, I got my kids to call these places
yes.
and work them out. And also the other thing is to hear me do it.
Yes.
So I think that actually was the first step.
Model
they
it.
Hear
That's great.
Modeling me do it. Not to say you need to sit here and listen, but making sure they're in the room at the time so that they can hear that I'm not getting aggressive, I'm being mm-hmm. assertive, but I'm getting it resolved, and they know that I persist until it gets resolved, and they know that about me, and
right.
I see that they're now doing it too.
That's
so
great.
I know for sure when they're on their own, they will both be able to manage those kinds of issues that come up, and I think that's such an important
mm-hmm.
skill for them
modeling.
To have. Now, on the other hand, I'm not a perfect parent because I still remind my 26-year-old when it's going to rain outside. So I'm
but
like
you didn't
your
get
mom.
The umbrella for her. Drive to her apartment and give it to her.
No, I don't
but
do
that. See,
but that is something that I need to work on as a parent. So
I think calling her and going, hey, you're going to go on your marathon run tomorrow. It's going to rain.
Yeah.
That's love. But going to the marathon and
yeah.
giving her the thing.
Right.
But I wanted to just mention two more things that came out of speaking to these return graduates.
Sure.
Is self-discipline and time management. And so the time management piece, a lot of them were saying, I don't know how to study and I don't know how to manage my time in university. The way that time is... or the way studying happens in university is gotten quite a bit farther than what's happening in high school. So I think to get students from grade 8 to start thinking about time management as a family, as a student, and how to study would really help them.
So again, modeling, right? So
modeling
it could
at home.
Could begin with like a family calendar and making sure
yeah,
that everybody...
Exactly.
You know, refers to that calendar or writes things down on the calendar so that they can understand the benefit of documenting. I mean, I know everybody does things digitally nowadays.
Well, you could do
I
the digital family calendar.
You could do that.
Yeah.
I still,
I
still find the big paper one, spiral bound, you know, is with big blocks that everybody can look at is still the best for me anyway.
But here's the shift with that calendar and sitting down as a family. homework is now starting to become a second priority to whatever's happening. And in university, homework is paramount.
Yeah.
They may have a course where they have two assignments in the entire course, an essay worth 50% and the exam worth 50%. Right. They've never seen that before.
Right.
They don't know how to do that. They may have a science course where they have three labs and an exam for the entire year. So if in grade 8, grade 7, of course we have all these safety valves, you know, if a kid can't do things on time, we try and help them. But if at
home, give them extensions.
But if at home we say to them, family calendar, you have your report that's due on Monday, but on the weekend we have a bar mitzvah and a, you know, a christening and all this stuff, so don't worry about it. Mm-hmm. I think it's so important to A, either, if it's absolutely impossible, have the child advocate for the extra time and negotiate that ahead of time.
Right.
And B, manage the time at home to say, no, this is your priority.
Or can I suggest a third option?
Sure, please.
Is to say, because we have the christening or the bar mitzvah on the weekend, when do you need to start the project so it'll be
and
done by
them.
The weekend so you can enjoy it? Even with my teenage clients, I will help them do a backwards calendar.
That's great.
So I say, this is your deadline. Let's go. And studying for exams, the same kind of thing. I always say to them, take it out of your head. Mm-hmm. Put it into blocks, you know. Every day have a different list. Like, I'm a big list believer.
No, it's
you know,
it's
and put it down amazing. On paper. So once you've done it, you don't even have to think about it. You just follow your own list. So I think modeling, now not everybody's brain is organized that way, so a lot of kids require more direction and guidance, but
and
I agree with you, the time management, because even like getting up in the morning, you know, a lot of parents, myself included, worry about my daughter getting up for university when I'm not there, because as much as we say we're not going to wake them up in the morning if they sleep in, I do.
Yeah, of
you know,
course.
I don't want it to be late for school every day.
Yeah.
So, and I know that kids stay up like really, really late and are sleep deprived and falling asleep in the classrooms. So that's a really hard one to help kids really understand. And there again, I've come to the conclusion that when my daughter goes to university next year, I've said to her, university is not high school. We're paying for this luxury.
Right.
If you can't be successful at university, I'm not going to continue to support you. So being successful means that you've, you know, and I have a feeling that when she's on her own, she will step up to the plate and she will get herself up on time. You're grimacing, saying maybe
no,
not.
No, I think it can happen, but it will happen. It will definitely happen.
It might not.
But the learning curve is so high.
Right, she might have to fall before she gets up
again.
Yeah,
and that's okay. But what I'm finding is that the mountain from high school to university has gotten huge with these soft skills, and we need to remind them. What's shocking students, and I think they used to know before, and your listeners should know that university professors are not teachers. They do not go to teacher's college. They do not think about, are the 1,000 people in front of me listening to me? Are they getting what I'm saying? Should I speak slowly? Should I do a handout, a PowerPoint? A university professor is someone who is an expert in their field. They're getting money from the university to continue in their field. As payback, they lecture.
Mm-hmm.
Then they go into tutorials, and the people running the tutorials are PhD students, not teachers.
Right.
So this generation of students have been used to, not this, all generations of students are used to having teachers going around. Like I answered, in a day, I answered the exact same question over and over and over. Because when I say it, some of the people listen. If I post it online, some of the people get it. If I hand it out, the other people get it. But there's a verbal learner.
Right.
It says, how many things do I have to do for it? And you have to explain it. In university, none of that will happen.
Yeah.
You know, when I hand back an assignment, I have all information-rich feedback.
Like
there's more writing on my feedback than the assignment sometimes. That won't happen in university.
Yeah.
Attendance won't happen in university.
Yeah.
So I think we can prepare our kids. I want to be very positive. I think hopefully people listening will say, I really like what you said, and I'm a real firm believer in respecting our young people. Respect, let them be part of it. Let them be part of their own journey. Let them take charge of what they want and what their weaknesses are. We're so much taking away the power from them.
And just to go back to another skill, we talked about laundry, for example. Mm-hmm. One of the things I just want to point out is it's amazing, you know, it's like laundry to them is like somebody coming to me and saying, fix this lawnmower,
that's
right?
Great.
It's like, I wouldn't know what button to start with. And to us, you know, as adults who do laundry, we've had years of practice.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to understand, I think, that they don't know even the basics sometimes. So my girls are responsible for sorting laundry. So I know at least she knows how to sort laundry. Some kids might not know. They would put all different colors in together. But to teach them the fundamentals in terms of breaking it down, mm-hmm. first you take laundry. I actually say, feel the material. You know, every material goes differently together. So very soft, cottony things go with soft, cottony things. Coarse tracksuit material goes with coarse tracksuit material. Mm-hmm. And then you further divide it by color, right?
Oh, that's great.
So it might be a lot of work, but it really maintains. Now, I don't expect her clothes to come back from university looking anything like they left with. But those, breaking it down into minute detail and not just putting on a piece of paper, but that is okay too, but actually getting your child to actually practice with you.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the first step is modeling. Second step is standing, mm-hmm. Standing next to your child while he or she does it.
Yeah.
And then the third step is you stepping away.
But I'd like to go back to what you said before. You know, what it would make an interesting summer as a coach parent,
yes.
to sit your child down and say, tell me the 10 things you're most worried about,
yes.
for starting in September.
Right.
And if they say, I'm worried about A, B, C, D, you coach them through it.
Right.
If it's laundry, then you do what you said. Let's go through a load. Take your device, video if you want.
Video's great.
Take pictures if you know,
yeah.
make notes for yourself, and that way you're empowering them.
Right.
What are you
they
most
feel more confident.
Worried about? And you know, now we're in the last little while of high school. If any of the things they say are academic based,
this is the time.
Encouraging them to go to their teacher and saying, you know what, I'm really worried about the writing. Well, go talk to your English teacher and they'll give you some tips maybe.
Right. So we've talked a lot about parents, children, teachers. I think, you know, I was going to ask you what age students should be helped to prepare, but it sounds like it could be as young as grade 7, 8 or even younger. I mean, this is a whole process,
yeah.
right?
I think the specific stuff, I would say grade 12. Once they've been accepted, the nitty-gritty things, you know, you go visit the university, you go through all these things. But the softer, bigger skills, I think, should start as a child.
Yeah.
And as it gets more academically difficult, you try and give them, I think, the reading, the self-discipline, time management, and some work-related experience. Even if it's 2 weeks, some kind of work-related experience.
And preferably not with a parent.
Or a family member.
Exactly.
Or where this...
Some real life, because real life is not the way that you would manage them in a job.
Yeah, I have a funny story. You know, someplace where they could get fired. My grandmother, what she did with her children in Sicily long, long time ago is she went to shopkeepers and gave them money secretly to hire her children. So they thought they were working for the shoe repair person or the whatever, and they were getting their weekly money, but it was her money.
Yeah.
But they were under the impression that they would get fired.
Right.
And, you know, and I've always
kept
that
model. It's a cool story.
Because when I've talked to my uncles, I said, yeah, I worked for the shoe repair guy, and then found out later the money was coming from
the
mother.
Did they find out later?
They found out later. They didn't know while they were working. They thought they held a job.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I think there's a lot of things as parent coach we could do.
Well, this is wonderful information. I think we've covered a lot of territory. And thank you so much for your time. It's been great getting to know you, not just as Chloe's favorite high school teacher, but as someone who's obviously so passionate about helping his students grow and learn beyond the classroom. Keep up the great work.
Yeah, thanks so much. I hope some of this stuff will help us be coach parents.
Thank you.